the task, I think, is to empower people to evaluate and analyze information so that they can arrive at what is an understanding of what is true and what is not in this world.
Welcome to a special episode of To The Max. Today, Zach and I are going to be featuring our interview with best-selling author, host of his own podcast, and the TV show Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. We feel he represents the podcast very well as one of the greatest scientific communicators of our time. With that being said, let's get right into the interview.
Hello, is this the right place?
Hello.
Hello.
Max and Zach?
Yes, hello.
Cool.
How is it going, Dr. Tyson? Just before we get started, what should we call you?
Yeah. You should call me Neil.
Oh, Neil, all right.
If I call you Max and Zach, you have to call me Neil.
Okay.
All right, fair enough.
Picture in here, hold on. Yeah, there we go.
Hello. That's a good background you've got there.
Yeah.
So happy to do this. And I think I came in at the right time.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Just on time.
Just on time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How is it? I mean, a little bit informal, but just before we get started, how's it going?
Yeah, that's fine. Well, you know, I'm COVID-free, so that's a good thing.
It's always a good thing.
That's a plus.
You know why I'm COVID-free? Because I listen to experts.
Wow.
I think that's what we all need to do.
Yeah.
What a concept.
I know. Why didn't anyone think of that one before?
Yeah, that's a fresh one. Yeah.
I think, I can tell you what just a few things before we start. Mm-hmm. So we're both students. I'm grade 10, he's grade 9. Mm-hmm. And during the...
What school?
I go to Air Camber, which is in Vancouver, and
I go to Sir Charles Tupper, and also in Vancouver.
Sir Charles, as in England, Sir Charles.
I think so, yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
Don't actually really know about...
The true origin of the school name.
I don't know, never really thought. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
You know, funny about names, because I grew up in an apartment complex in New York City.
Right.
And it's called the Skyview Apartments. And to me, there was just a name. And then one day I looked at it and said, it's a Skyview. Wait a minute. Because that's where my earliest interest in the universe was blossomed. And I never made the connection until I was like way grown up.
Right.
Back on it. So names can just be placeholders for things, but not begging you to interpret what they mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I want to say nice jersey.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, well, it's the away jersey for the New York Yankees, and I'm born in the Bronx.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, right.
Max, you're the baseball guy. When do the Yankees play?
I think they just came off a series with the Blue Jays.
Did they?
Yeah, they're doing a lot of doubleheaders too, 7-inning doubleheaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, because the whole audience is fake, right?
Baseball season's pretty weird this year.
There was that one game yesterday where I don't remember who, but I think it was the 8th inning, and they had 29 runs.
29?
It was unbelievable. It was like 29-9 in the 8th inning.
Wow. Really?
Oh, man, that is insane.
Yeah, I think that
I got to see the review of that game. A lot of home runs for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
I have to search that up after.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I think just... The thing about sports is some baseball teams have so little fans, like Tampa, that those games look honestly more packed right now.
Yeah.
Oh.
All the cardboard fans. About the same attendance rate they'd get.
What I like are the cardboard fans that have face masks. That's an interesting.
Yeah.
Weird.
Spreading the message.
I mean, I think it's nice what they've done to maintain a sense of normalcy while you're watching the games.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Makes it feel normal, I guess, and the crowd noise. So I think they've done a good job when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Zach, do you want to get into this? Do you want to?
Sure. So yeah, we just have.
So you're recording, I see. So let's get in. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So we've got just some little intro questions that we'll ask you just at the beginning, just some like little easy questions, and then me and Max each have a couple just bigger questions that aren't like just little intro questions, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. We'll see where it goes. Obviously, we'll probably have some questions just based off answers and stuff, so you know.
Plus technically you never really know if you're asking a difficult question, because it's whether the answer is difficult.
Yeah.
Some questions are easy with difficult answers, some questions are difficult with easy answers.
So. That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so I think our first question, I think one that I've been wondering since the first time that the email was answered, why did you actually come and join us? Because you know, we're two friends that are still in high school that are just doing a podcast about science and stuff. And why did you come and join us, I think?
Well, a few reasons. First, if I were in high school, I would want me to join me in my podcast. So a little bit of, let me go into their shoes, first of all. Second, I admire people who take initiatives, who want to do something different, a little bold, a little audacious. I admire that. I don't care who else has been on someone's podcast. There's this urge, you know, I get some solicitation to appear and they say, oh, by the way, we've also had these people on, and they're like, some are famous or whatever. And they're trying to get me to say, oh, well, yeah, those famous people, then I should do it. That's like not the reason to do a podcast. Okay. That, in my opinion, a podcast should be a genuine blossom of the curiosity and interest of the host. And to the extent that I can contribute to that, and if in fact I am more famous than other guests, it'll help bring attention to the podcast, right? If I'm less famous than your average guest, then it might dilute it, I guess. But I guess you wouldn't be asking me even if I was less famous. So I'm here to serve a greater cause. Yeah. And I'll also say that, you know, I was in 12th grade, not 10th grade, but when I first met Carl Sagan, he invited me to visit him at his Cornell office, Cornell, New York, Ithaca, New York, the Cornell University.
Yeah.
And I was asking the same question you're asking me. Why did he make time for me? I'm just a 17-year-old kid. And he's famous and he wrote these books and was on TV. And why is he doing this? And that's when I vowed to myself that if I am ever as remotely famous as he is, because I'm in high school at the time, if I'm ever remotely that famous, I will give time to students the way he has given it to me. And so that's been a part of me. So it's not this is not a chore, it's a duty. And so that's how I see it.
Wow.
So don't mess it up.
We will follow in your path.
Wow. Like, at the time when you met Carl Sagan, did you already know you wanted to be an astrophysicist or someone a scientist to do with space?
I don't think it ever works if you push people. I mean, you can, and sometimes it works, but generally to push someone, it means they're not arriving at their destination by their own, on their own steam, from their own internal curiosities. And they might even still be good at the subject, but my experience with this and others is that later on they choose a different career and one that is better aligned with their native natural interests rather than the interests of their parents or of their friends or others who are trying to push them.
If you're trying to,
I was interested in the universe from age 9, which was codified by the time I was 11. So meeting Carl Sagan was the continuance of this expressed interest. So no, it was not his influence that got me interested in the universe. By the way, just to be clear, you can be inspired by someone and say, well, I never knew that. I want to do this subject, but that's different from someone pushing you to do it. I just want to be clear. Many people have come to me and said, I became a scientist because of you. I didn't push them, all right? I'd maybe help them find their guide star, all right? But in the sky for what they want to do or what they want to be when they grow up. So my interest in the universe, I know, was authentic and genuine and self-driven. Neither of my parents are a scientist. My brother's an artist. My sister's in business. And so it really formed out of the purest of circumstances.
Wow.
I mean, just speaking of inspiration, I just want to say I really appreciate the Cosmos Space Time Odyssey, the TV show you did, because I watched that when I was pretty young and I just absolutely loved it. And I went back to watch it just, you know, a few days ago, just before this interview. And man, I still love it. I think
it had the same effect as it did that long time ago when we first.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. And of course, in a few days, I don't know what the broadcast schedule is in Canada. If you're near the border, it's probably similar, near the U.S. border. But the next one, Cosmos Possible Worlds, which first aired in March on National Geographic, but no one your age saw it.
Yeah.
Because it only appeared at a certain time on the television, and you had to like put that in your schedule sit on a couch and watch it. And nobody your age does that. No, what do? You like stream it for whatever it is.
You're ready to Disney Plus.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't watch cable.
Exactly. So the next, it will air again just on September 22nd on Fox.
Time to put that on my calendar.
Yeah, I'm going to be there.
And so that's another airing on the couch. It's a couch airing, but I'm told, and I don't have the very latest word on this, but I'm told that after that, it will also be made available to stream on Hulu. Ooh. Then everyone younger than 30 will get to see it.
Yeah, they'll have the time.
Because they'll force the time in their calendar.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited for that because I really loved your Cosmos.
Yeah, this one's even bigger. I know it sounds cliche to say that one's latest project is the best one because so many sequels to movies are really crappy, all right, in spite of what everyone attempts to say about them. But this one has much deeper investments in the storytelling and in the visual effects. And because there's a lot of, we're spending more time imagining a future Earth. And that took more effort on the computer to get that right and to get that, to bring you into the scene so that it feels authentic to you and that you want to embrace it.
Yeah. And well, 9 years ago, I think that's when it first came out. The graphics then were still pretty good. So if you're improving from then, it's going to be.
Yeah, it's definitely. Be better. You're talking about 2014. So that's 6 years ago.
Yeah, 6 years ago.
Yeah. Nice. I mean, I'm excited for that.
Very excited.
Oh, man.
All right, Max, do you have one more question or do you want me to ask mine?
Go ahead.
All right, go ahead. So, Neil, something that I have just been wondering and just been thinking about, I've read your book, Origins.
But just for those listening,
I
did give them permission to call me Neil.
Don't worry, guys. We're on a first-name basis here.
Yeah, if I say I'll call you Max, you can call me Neil. All right, that's what that is. Okay, yeah. Just in case anybody was wondering.
Yeah.
We did that before you started recording, I think.
Yeah, and so something I've been interested in is the topic and subject of dark matter and dark energy. And in your book, Origins, you cover that, and you cover that in two chapters. And I find them very fascinating because, well, they make up, 90% of all energy and matter in the universe, but we know so little about them. And I think when there's room for something to be discovered, I find that very cool. And, it kind of drives me to say, I want to be the first one to discover that, even though, it's going to take a lot of effort, but, it's a start. And so I guess my question to you is that in the time that we are where we don't really know how so much about it, if, say, we were to discover it, how really important would that be just to unlocking really stuff that we don't know? And if we were to discover what it is, just what would we know with this information? What becomes possible if we do discover?
I think just for the listeners, just if you could explain dark matter and dark energy in the best possible way. I don't know.
Did you think I wouldn't?
Yeah.
No, just.
Who you think you told me on the show?
Yeah.
So first of all, if you read it in Origins, that's a fatter book than others I've written. We're just now, this year, updating that book because it was about 8 years old. And so there's a lot of updates in it, including updates on dark energy and dark matter and this sort of thing. So just to be clear, about 85% of all the gravity we measure in the universe has no known origin.
Right.
So we can look up all the black holes and planets and stars and gas clouds and they make galaxies. Add it all up, you get 15% of the gravity operating on the motions of bodies in the universe.
Which is a small amount,
We don't know what's causing it. We don't know anything. And in a way, it's like at night looking at in an ocean and seeing just sort of the white caps from the wind blowing it. And you can see that in the moonlight, but you don't really see the ocean too well. You just see the white caps. And you see all the white caps, that's all there is. And then the sun rises and you see this entire ocean.
Yeah.
So to recognize, which happened in the last few decades, that everything we know and love and care about of the universe represents 15% of the gravity that's manifesting. That's, you know, that's a sorry state that we're in.
Yeah. It's not, a very small percentage.
I exaggerate a little. I'll explain why in a moment. In addition to this, there's a mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space forcing the universe to accelerate in its expansion. We measure that the universe is expanding. And we know that all the gravity, dark matter and regular matter, should be slowing down that expansion, possibly even making it reverse.
Yeah, collapse.
The big
collapse.
Crunch.
Exactly. That's possible. That's a legit outcome of this scenario. But when we notice, we find out that there's a pressure in the vacuum of space that is acting in the opposite sense of gravity, forcing the universe to not only expand, which it could do, but accelerate. We don't know what's causing that either. And when you add up that which is making the universe accelerate and that which is the gravity that we don't, whose origin we don't know, you get to 95%, 95, 96% of what is driving this universe. So we know and understand 4% of the universe, but we know and understand that really well. We can be proud of that little 4% of what we know. We can do a hole in one in a spaceship sent to Mars, land in a crater, you know, that's 20 million miles away, launched from Earth on two moving platforms. So we do well for what entire IT revolution, quantum physics, general relativity, thermodynamics, all these branches of physics, our understanding of chemistry, the periodic table, all of that does not require dark matter or dark energy to master. That's why we're pretty comfortable in our 4%. Now, once we find out what is causing the rest of the, what's driving the universe, it might not make any difference at all. So instead of giving it this mysterious name, dark matter, we find out, oh, there's actually gremlins. Okay, so gremlins are doing this. Okay. Does it just need a name, right, instead of a mystery name? Okay. We already know some of the properties of what we're calling dark matter. We interact with it gravitationally. That's how we know it's there. But it doesn't interact with our light or our molecules or the entire electromagnetic force. You've heard of E&M, electricity and magnetism. That whole world does not interact with dark matter, whatever the dark matter is. So light passes right through it. You can't touch it because it doesn't know how to interact with your molecules. So it's been hypothesized that maybe there's a new class of particle that does not interact with us. And by all measure, doesn't even interact with itself. Otherwise, you'd find pockets of dark matter where it interacted and it made dark matter molecules and dark matter planets and dark matter stars. We don't see any evidence.
Yeah, we haven't found any of that.
So it's just like flowing around?
It's just flowing, exactly. It's just floating, but still there. Okay, so we can map. We have maps of where we find the dark matter. And of course, our matter is just the froth in the dark matter oceans. So the point is, the dark matter, the presence of dark matter and the dark energy has already shown up in our equations. And we're calculating with it. So the discovery of what it is not going to change those equations. So in other words, it's not a discovery out of the blue. Oh my gosh, who ordered that? Where did that come? No, we know. So we know it's there. We know what's there. That's why it's not something that's going to go away. You know, it's not like, I don't know how much history of science you've read, but 19th century, it was hypothesized that space was permeated with something called the ether.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Why did we think that? Well, light comes in waves, right? And so does sound.
And sound needs...
Well, you need air to transmit sound. If this was a vacuum in space...
Right.
There would be nothing to vibrate and bring the sound energy to your ears. So there is no sound in space, much to the dismay of fans of Star Wars. That would be silent movie for most of the...
That'd be pretty boring to watch.
It would be pretty boring or to listen to, right.
Yeah.
So people hypothesized, we know waves require a medium that they can vibrate to get from one place to another. Light is a wave, so there must be some medium out there in the vacuum of space.
Right.
It's not like any medium we've ever seen before, But what properties would it have to have? Well, it's got to be able to transmit light and not change its color and do all these things. And so they hypothesized the ethereal ether. And we went for decades just trying to figure out the properties of the ether, but no one ever measured it. And then we learned that light does not require a medium through which to vibrate. It's a self-generating packet of energy. Then we dropped the ether overnight because it was not working from the beginning, but it was the only way we knew how to think about that problem. So all I'm trying to say is dark matter, dark energy is not like the ether. We never had a measurement of the ether. It was always just hypothesized.
Right.
Mm. We have measurements of what dark energy is doing.
We have more information now.
We have calculations that work with it.
Correct. So that's why they're not commensurate problems. And you're right. So now maybe it just fits in the equation. Now we have a word for it, whereas before we didn't. Fine. What's more fun might be that once we discover what it is, we find out that something else we didn't understand
makes sense now
in the light of that new understanding.
Mm.
So understanding dark matter would then bring a suite of solutions with it that had perplexed us for so long and we didn't even know were related.
Right.
Yeah. So for me, that would be the most exciting kind of development in science.
Absolutely.
If we do ultimately learn what dark matter and dark energy are.
Oh, yeah. It could answer a lot of other questions that we would have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, solve a lot of problems.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that would be really nice.
Yeah. One day. Max, you want to get into your question now?
Well, I'm sure you have I just want to say, like, you are one of the greatest scientific communicators of our time, at least, and maybe even of all time, I'd say. Just.
Oh, well, thank you.
Completely unbiased. It's not like you're on the podcast right now.
Yeah.
And you're in ninth grade, so you have your worldly-wise opinion. Okay.
Yeah.
But I just want to ask, how do, like, because Cosmos was a show that I appreciated when I was even younger, and it's a show that I still appreciate now. How do you explain science to everyone, make it available to absolutely everyone? Like,
that's hard. It's hard. So a couple of things. One of the biggest compliments I can get is if someone comes up to me after I give a talk or a lecture or something and say, oh, you're so natural at this. They have no idea how much work I've actually put into it so that in the end, it looks like it's natural. So I'll take it as a compliment of how much work I've put into it, even though they think I've put no work into it at all. That's my first point. Second, I think many educators fall into the trap of saying to themselves, if I'm going to teach you this, here's the lesson plan. Here's the syllabus. And I'm going to make sure we get everyone, because that's the full knowledge of what's going on here. And then they present it to you and every 5 minutes, half the audience dazes off. And because they feel obligated to give you all the details. So in a way I'm bypassing that. I'm looking at the page and I'm saying, this is really interesting. This doesn't sound interesting, but I think I can make it interesting. This has no hope for being interesting. And so I will cull from this list kind of the coolest mind-blowing things that that my science can deliver. Then I'll present that to you. You'll then say, this is amazing. This is what I want to learn more. Then you'll get closer to the material and you'll dig into the weeds and the bits and pieces that I left out, because now I have you hooked. You're there. And now you become a self-learner, because now you want to learn about it. You're not just suffering under some lecture that I'm handing to you. So I'm very particular about what I share with people on the hope and expectation that it's just the right recipe of length and humor and enlightenment that they get excited and they want to come back for more. So that's an important dimension to this exercise. And another important dimension, which was picked up by Anne Druyan, who's the widow of Carl Sagan. She's the secret sauce in all the cosmoses, right? It's one thing to do a science documentary, but it's another one for the documentary to compel you to think and feel what the science is and what it means and what your place is within it. That takes someone with much more sort of liberal arts chops than what I have. And that's what Andrewian brings to the table as co-author of all three cosmoses from the very beginning. Because she doesn't just, she's not a scientist herself, but she's scientifically, profoundly scientifically literate in a socially conscious way. And so when she writes, she will put together storylines of scientists of the past whose life you have never heard of, but you should, and talk about the struggles and how it fits. And you then analogize to today. You know, why did society reject this person's warnings? What was going on in society then? Oh, they, what do they know? And then you look, oh my gosh, that's happening today. So that level of connectivity requires a whole other attention, a whole other sphere of communicating that involves storytelling. And from childhood, if you can put a good storyteller in the room, then everybody's attention is rapt by them. You sit around the campfire, you just sit in a circle, and one person just tells a story. I don't know if you go, if you ever, does your school, go to your elementary schools or your kindergarten, and if someone is sitting in the middle telling a story, all the kids are like this.
Listening.
Yes. One yes. More. And maybe by adulthood, we've lost that patience, or maybe not. We do like good stories and movies that take us on adventures. And for the readers out there, they love a good novel.
Absolutely.
So I think that's something that does persist into adulthood.
Yeah.
And of course, stories were communicated long before the majority of society was even literate. And what are the constellations, if not a repository of stories of the gods of the day when they were first formulated? And every culture of the world has sky lore that plugs into their own origins and their own values and the things they care about in their society. So I think a well-conceived presentation factors all of this in.
Yeah, because stories really are one of the most fundamental things for humans as far as it goes, because it really goes back all the way cave paintings.
Paintings, of course. Right. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and that calls for the value of art as well, because the artists are people who have ways of communicating. By the way, I use art with a capital A. So that could be writers, producers, sculptors, painters, people who invent a new way to communicate a thought or an idea or especially a feeling using a medium that maybe wasn't previously known. So one last thing about that is I have found that I'm more effective if I know a little something about the pop culture in which the audience has been immersed. So I'll read current events of recent weeks. I'll see, you know, what did Beyonce do? Or did the Pope do something? Or did the, you know, what did Trump say something?
Yeah.
Was there a rocket launch? And I'll gather this so that when I read the audience and find out, are they leaning this way or that way? What's their humor level? What's their political leaning? I can then draw upon things they already know, and that gets them at least halfway. And then I meet them halfway with the science that I attach to their pop culture.
Yeah.
I found it to be particularly potent.
Yeah.
Well put. You have another one?
Okay, so I do have a question that it's one that I've had actually for quite a while, surprisingly. Ever since I had a project and I was doing it about black holes, because I found them interesting. I mean, I think most of us can agree that they're one of the most just interesting things out there in the cosmos that a lot of people know about. And
no bout a doubt it.
Yeah.
And I had one of the questions that our teacher actually gave us was just like, obviously for whatever topic we picked, what is something that we can do that could positively impact society? And obviously I was trying to think of something we could use a black hole to help society, and the project's already done. You're not helping me with my homework, but do you have any ideas of if there is anything positive to do with black holes? Because, you know, they're quite scary things, you know, for a lot of people.
Yeah. So I learned general relativity, which is the theoretical foundations to understand black holes. Einstein proposed that gravity, that matter and energy matter and energy manifest in space-time as the curvature of space-time.
Right.
And so if you have very severe curvature, you get, and the light doesn't even come out, you get a black hole. So a black hole is the region of space where light doesn't come out. And you want to do something practical with a black hole. In the book that I learned this from, there's a part of a chapter called a black hole garbage disposal. So they imagine if you could sort of put a black hole in orbit around the Earth, and then you have these sort of rocket loads that enter, go into an intersecting orbit with the black hole, and then all the garbage just falls into the black hole. And you got to do it with a lot of garbage, otherwise
it wouldn't be efficient.
You got to be efficient, and then it's gone forever. It's not polluting anything. It's not, and the black hole ripped it apart anyway, back to its constituent atoms. So you no longer ask the question, is it still plastic? Well, is plastic made of atoms?
Yeah.
Then it's atoms, all right?
Yeah.
So I can imagine a black hole in a very sophisticated society where we have total control over space and time and matter and energy, that the black hole could be the world's wastebasket or trash bin or landfill, if you will. Now, if you feed a black hole, it grows. So you got to sort of factor that in.
Yeah, you can't grow it too much. You don't want it
You can't grow it too much because then, guess what? It'll eat Earth.
You might fall in.
So that's what I would say. Otherwise, I can't think of anything. And generally, it takes clever engineers to connect a frontier science topic to
something
to something that could be practical and useful.
Right. Yeah,
I think, and by the way, that doesn't happen instantly.
Yeah,
that right? The quantum physics on which all information technology is based, because there is no creation, storage, or retrieval of digital information without exploiting quantum physics. Quantum physics was discovered in the 1920s. It would take 50 years or so before people started feeling comfortable with what a computer is and what it can do and letting them into your home. And before it became a commercial
item,
before it became a consumer product,
right.
You get your smartphone, practically at the checkout line of Kmart, right? Yeah. It's just,
everyone's got one.
What it took to get there was many decades. So imagine someone back in the 1920s saying, no, don't do quantum physics. Why are you doing that? You can't even see the atom. Why are you wasting your time and money and energy? You should do something practical. And meanwhile, as much as at least a third of the GDP, you learn that in economics, the third of the value of all goods and services produced by the world are traceable to information technology, or information technology has impacted I'd say at least a third of the value of all goods and services produced in the world,
which is a huge amount.
It's huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
It's clearly become one of the most important parts of our culture for a lot of people. And
correct. And just since you're still in school, GDP stands for gross domestic product, and gross means it adds. It doesn't mean it's nasty. It just adds it all up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So adds up all the sectors. So the gross sum of it. And domestic means everything that happens in your country. And the product is the catchword for goods and services.
Yeah. Right.
And the wealth of your country, however, is not solely measured by how big is your GDP. The United States has the biggest GDP in the world. Next is, I think, is China, then Japan, and then a few others. But China used to be much lower down, and now they're much higher up. Another indicator is the GDP per person, per capita, right? Per capita, per person, same thing. So now you take the wealth of the country and divide it by how many people are in your country.
Right.
So that gives you a sense of, is there a lot of poverty? Is there, how are you managing that wealth?
Yeah, does it even out?
Yeah. Because sometimes you can have like a really good economy, but, a big wealth disparity in some place, like some parts.
And right, stuff. Right. If it only goes to a few people and you have millions of people in poverty, you divide that GDP by millions of people and you see the total GDP and you see per person, you say something's not.
Yeah.
Something doesn't add up.
Amicably.
Right.
I think another question I have is just, it's a little bit random, but do you think we'll ever become a multi-planet species? Because Do you even think that's a good idea? Because some people think, you know, we should just focus on Earth first. But I want to hear your opinion on that.
Earth first or Mars?
Yeah, yeah. So the Earth, I have a message to the Earth people out there. So let's go back 30,000 years and we're all in the cave.
Yeah.
And I transport you, the Earth person, back into the cave with the rest of us. And the two of you and I say, we want to go out and explore this valley or that mountain over there or that river. No one's been there before. So we're extending our frontier. I don't know what I'll find. It could be dangerous. And then the person in the cave says, no, we have cave problems we have to solve. Let's solve the cave problems first before anyone leaves the cave. This is what Earth people sound like to me today. Why are we going into space when we have problems here on Earth?
So I'm going to avoid them.
Exactly. So anyone hearing the cave example would realize how patently absurd it would be to prevent people from exploring. You can find new water sources, new medicines, new plants, new food sources. You can learn about the world in ways that can enhance your life back in the cave. So that's my reply to the Earth people. Right. Now, with regard to multi-planet species, I'm at odds with Carl Sagan, Stephen Hawking, and others for the reason we should do this. They would say we need to be a multi-planet species because if we're all on one planet, that's putting all the eggs in one basket. And if an asteroid comes, we could all become extinct. Whereas if humans are on multiple planets, then a disaster, a virus can afflict one planet, but we still will move on, carry on in our species. Okay. So my reply to that is, that, I mean, it makes a good headline, by the way, but it's not, I don't see it as very practical because whatever effort it takes to terraform Mars, then ship a billion people there, whatever effort that takes, it seems to me it's less effort to deflect the asteroid that's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
Less effort to find a magic viral serum that will handle any virus. Okay. Right. It just seems to me, am I?
No, I see where you're coming from.
I think I agree with that because the amount of effort that it would actually take to just to terraform Mars, not even including shipping people there. I mean, if you're willing to put that much effort, aren't you just willing to try and prevent the disaster from happening?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So I want to be a Martian like the next person, but I'm just being practical about the motives for why you might want to do this. Right. And on Mars, by the way, if you go there, and we have humans on more than one planet, I don't have a problem with that at all. I think what's more realistic is that we'll turn Mars into a vacation spot.
Like a Caribbean resort.
Yeah, exactly. The Martian resort, the Caribbean resort. And that could be fun. And I'd save up several cycles of vacation money to take that trip.
Yeah.
You wouldn't do that. You wouldn't go every season because it'd probably be too expensive.
Pretty expensive, I guess.
Yeah, very, very expensive.
Very, 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 very expensive. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I think that is a practical way to use Mars as a vacation spot because it actually does make sense as far as, you know, and they probably rely on tourism as, you know, a place to survive and just like a Caribbean place.
And all the money.
Why else would anyone go to the desert of Nevada if there weren't Las Vegas?
Exactly. No other reason.
Las Vegas basically landed from space.
Yeah.
There was, if you saw Las Vegas before Las Vegas, it's like, what?
You don't want to go there.
So you make a vacation spot.
Yeah,
why not?
Put casinos on Mars. There you have it.
You'll get everyone going there now.
New business idea.
I mean, they'll have to save up a lot more because if they're going to pay for the trip and then lose all their money gambling.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You need the emergency fund for the people who are not wise.
You have to dip into the emergency funds to get back.
Yeah, the threat of getting left on Mars because you can't buy the ticket back.
There are some people that are going to Mars just to stay there, aren't there?
The one-way ticket?
Oh, yeah.
I don't like that idea. I mean, just it seems.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem.
Obviously, you know, some people
they analogize themselves to the pilgrims coming from
Europe
to the New World. And they were on one-way trips, so they want to be just like that. And my reply to that is, you know, when the pilgrims landed, there were other human beings there to greet them.
Yeah.
They could breathe the air where they landed. And it's, you know, it's the same air that when they left the shores of Spain or of England or of the Netherlands. And, you know, something, the trees are made of wood.
Just
the trees where you came, so you can repair your ship.
It's a somewhat familiar environment.
And you might have fruits you don't recognize, but other people are eating them, and they're actually quite tasty. So to be on, to go on a one-way trip to Mars, I just don't see that. I don't see that as having the attraction that it might have had for immigrants centuries ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the most, well, speaking from like a life standpoint, it's not the prettiest place to go.
When right.
You're looking at no air. You have to live inside. You don't even get to go outside unless you've got a, 20-pound, 50-pound spacesuit on?
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, it weighs less on Mars, but still.
Yeah.
And you're what was I saying? You
inside your little what's it?
You have to stay inside all those pods.
Yeah. So what you're really going to be is in a HAB module on Mars. You're going to be on Earth on Mars.
Yeah.
And what you're not going to be on Mars unless Mars.
You just get to look out the window.
Just look out the window, and hell, I can have a high resolution screen.
Yeah. Just right there.
Right. So high resolution that you can't tell whether you are in
Earth or Mars.
It reminds me, if you go to sort of the penguin part of a zoo and they put him in this chilled water, and on the wall they sort of painted an iceberg. And I'm like, is that fooling the penguin? I don't know. Yeah. If it is.
You've done good then.
You've done good, and do it for us.
Yeah, why not?
But I remember what I was going to say, that the Antarctica is warmer, balmier, and wetter than the most hospitable place on Mars.
And we can breathe there.
That's right.
And you can breathe, yet you don't find people lining up to build condominiums there.
But, right. I mean, I think the thing with Mars is it just probably has, like, obviously it's less hospitable, but I think the reason you would see people going there is just because it seems more exotic than Antarctica.
Sounds cool.
I guess.
But I think there are other cool things too that you can do that might also put your life at risk, as would going to Mars. You know, bungee cord jumping is cool and put your life at risk.
Yeah.
I mean, the reason I would like to go to Mars is to play sports there. I could finally actually hit a home run.
Yeah.
I'd be like a superhuman.
Yeah.
Except everyone else would be superhuman too, so I wouldn't be special.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one is special if everyone is special.
This is
the takeaway from, what's the movie? Not the Fantastics, the
Incredibles.
The Incredibles, thank you. Yes, that's the takeaway from The Incredibles.
Yeah.
If everyone is special, then no one is special.
But
so you'd have
fun
to play against native Martians who don't have your Earth strength.
Yeah.
That'd be a fair matchup.
Just let some people go there for their one-way trip, go a couple generations, and then I go back. They're all used to that gravity there, and I just
kick their ass, right?
Yeah. Send the ball 1,000 feet in the air.
What is the gravity like? Just compared
40%
to
40% of Mars. So what do you weigh here on Earth?
120. So
pounds, I guess.
Yeah, pounds.
Yeah. So you'd weigh 58 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
Did I say that right? 120 pounds. So you'd weigh 48 pounds.
48.
Yeah. You'd have the strength for 120 pounder, but with the weight of a 40 pounder. So you can do heroic things. Yes.
Jumping and.
Yeah, jumping would be fun.
Yeah, yeah.
Just jumping around.
Huge
on Mars.
Jumps.
Yeah.
That would be really cool.
That'd be really cool.
What sport would you play on Mars, Zach?
On Mars? Oh, I'd probably bring a soccer ball and I'd just kick it as hard as I can and see how far
the problem
ball
is. You can't bend the arc. There's atmosphere there, but it's very thin.
Right, just keep going up, right?
No. Well, it would just, you couldn't put arc in the
curve. Oh, right, you can't curve it, right.
You can't bend the kick, as they call it. Bend it like Beckham. because the air pressure isn't high enough to enable that.
Right.
So that means all kicks will just be straight.
Right, right.
I mean, they'd still be going pretty fast if I were kicking it, though.
Yeah.
No, it won't go faster than you can kick it on Earth because your kick is a force
I guess
putting a mass into motion. Realize that. and so the mass hasn't changed. It's just the weight. So you kick it, and it's the mass. So what will happen? It'll have more hang time.
Hang time.
That's what's going to happen. Yeah.
Wait. So planes wouldn't work on Mars just because they don't have.
They would just need really big wings.
Really.
Yeah. Because you get lift from the air pressure.
And there's
the
just
difference
not.
In air pressure from above and below. And the latest rover to Mars actually has an onboard drone, a helicopter, and they're going to see and with huge blades. So they want to see the feasibility of flying around Mars, because if you can fly, then you can go over a ledge in ways the rover can't, and with cameras, it gives you much more versatility. So it's a test of concept.
Yeah, because if that works, that would probably be a big step as far as, you know, just doing things on Mars.
Yeah, doing things, mobility things a lot on Mars. Easier. Mobility,
yeah. Exactly. And just probably even setting up, if you were actually going to go live there, I mean, you probably need some sort of flying transport just to get around.
Yeah, not only that, but you want some recon on whether you got a good place to live or not.
Yeah.
So like over that ridge, send the help, send the chopper, send the drone.
That's cool. I didn't know they were building a drone to go.
Yeah. They just launched it a few weeks ago. So it'll get there in February. So watch. Mm. It'll be surely big news if the thing successfully flies.
Yeah. That'd be a big step. That'd be a big step in the right direction.
Zach, any questions?
I think we should get into your one there that you have.
Okay, so I have a big question. I think this is probably going to be the final question.
Okay.
And it kind of sums up just, you know, about communicating science and stuff. Because, you know, okay, so in our world, we are very dependent on science. Probably the most dependent that we've ever been.
Ever.
Yeah.
And yet we have a surprising amount of people with very loud voices that are anti-science. And I just find it very strange that, like, honestly, they're tweeting on Twitter, and that is science. That would not be possible without any advancements in science.
They like to disprove science using technology made by science.
And you can't. Yes. And they sometimes just try and pick and choose the science that they want to be real or not. So, first of all, why do these people even really exist? Like, how did they come to this in the first place? And second, is there anything that all of us can do? Like, I mean, I know we have a podcast, but like, is there anything everyone can do to just try?
Well, podcast is a start. I think the people like that have to be able to exist if you want to live in a free society. And a free society means freedom of speech. So I don't have a problem with people who feel that way. My concern is, as you correctly noted, some of these people have pulpits from which they convince other people.
When they spread their influence.
And if these people, correct. And if these people have the power to spread nonsense, it means their audience doesn't have the ability to detect that it's nonsense. That's what that means.
Yeah.
You can blame the people all you want, but the purveyors all you want. But in the end of the day, if they are gathering people by the flocks, it means the flocks had no
critical.
They were not inoculated against charlatans in this way. So for me, as an educator, somewhere in the curriculum, we're going to have to introduce the ability to know when someone else is full of shit. Okay. Forgive my French, as they say. We need tools to be able to determine that. And you got to check your gullibility and say, I want to believe that, but you know, I should be skeptical. Right. I want to believe it because it feels good to me. Yeah, I want to. Tell me more. But wait, maybe it's not true. And the bias you bring upon yourself by wanting something to be true and then testing to see if it is true, if you're biased, that can even affect the test that you conduct.
Like,
you can only pick out the data that matches what you want it to be
right.
and ignore the data that doesn't.
Yeah, you see what you want to see.
Yeah, you see what you want to see. That's one of the more severe biases that are out there.
Right.
And it's called a selection bias, is what that is. The varieties of selection bias. So for me as an educator, and you as a budding educators, the task, I think, is to empower people to evaluate and analyze information so that they can arrive at what is an understanding of what is true and what is not in this world. And not only that, no one understands the methods and tools of science and how they work and why they work and what the limits are. Okay, and how do you recognize those limits, but not throw away that which has been hard earned and does in fact work in society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do your own equations, figure it out yourself.
Or find a source that you trust and then apply that. But for people to say, you know, I once tweeted, because remember when we got that photo of a black hole that was made headlines all around.
Yeah.
So I gave a sequence of comments. I said, the scientist, we discovered a black hole and first time got a picture of it public. Ooh. Ah. Wow. Okay. Scientist, humans are causing global warming. Public. I choose not to agree with that result.
No.
That's why I tried to juxtapose those two scenarios.
That's the weird thing. It's just so weird that they pick.
They pick and choose what they want to believe.
Yeah. Cherry picking, I think.
Cherry picking, yeah. Because, I mean, if you trust one thing they tell you, just because the other thing might not be as appealing to you, you have to probably give it the same weight that you gave the other thing.
Yeah, at least give it a chance.
Give it a chance, yeah.
Don't just throw it out the window the second you hear the claim.
Right.
Yeah. So I think it is important, though, that most of us continue to use critical thinking and just continue to make the proper decisions, because if we don't, eventually we will run the earth to a halt, whether it be eventually with climate change or something else that just happens. So we have to make sure that we're scientifically literate. I think it is one of the most important things for the upcoming generations.
And if you know that, that gives me hope for the future. Because it doesn't look good out there now.
Yeah, I know.
It definitely doesn't. Yeah. But I mean, I think it could be worse.
Yeah.
I mean, we could be.
Well, I keep telling myself that makes me feel a little better about even the bad things in the world, but still.
But then you could say it could be better. You could.
It
say
could be it way could better. Be, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
But yeah. I think there's still room for everything to be, for us to, we haven't done any, we haven't done anything that's completely irreversible yet. I think
there's still time. Well, no,
there are things that are irreversible, but we'll land in a different place where we'll still survive it.
Yeah.
The truly irreversible thing would be setting something into motion where we end up extinct.
Yeah.
That would be bad.
The hope is we avoid that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But I think we still have a good chance, and especially with there's a stress on trying to become keep everyone scientifically literate and trying to make people have critical thinking, especially in school. I've seen a shift into more, you know, actually thinking about trying to figure out why this happens, not just this happens, but let's find out why this happens and let's test it. That's the scientific method. And
very important.
It's very important.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be it.
Okay. Well, good luck with the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's been amazing.
And I hope you do well in your science classes.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Take care.
All right. See you later.
Bye. Thank you.
So that's it. Hope you guys enjoyed that interview. I want to thank Neil for coming on the podcast. I also want to thank his executive producer for getting us in touch and helping this be possible. If you guys want to check him out, you can find him on Twitter, Instagram. He's verified. You'll find him. While you're there, also check out us at To The Max Podcast. You'll probably find us. There's links down below. So I really enjoyed this interview. Thanks, everyone. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. And catch you guys in another episode. Have a safe and fantastic rest of your day. And make sure to take it to the max.